Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have the whole cast, well, most of the cast, a director, producer, the two main leads, the only two leads we really want anyway, from the Lost Treasure of the Valley. Welcome to the show, because there's four people here. I'm going to get them all introduce themselves for a change. Go ahead.
The star goes first.
Yeah. Everardo. Good.
Hi. All right. Hi, I'm Everardo Barriga, and I play Jake, the young photographer.
And I'm Lori Beth Denberg. I play Jake's landlord, who loves him but is sick of him because he doesn't contribute and he's kind of a loser.
I'm Rob Houston. I am the very lucky writer, director of this crazy short film, and couldn't have been happier with the awesome cast we were lucky to assemble.
And I'm John Sklaroff. I'm the producer. Like Bob said, I was very lucky to work on this project. I'm very excited as to what we're doing with it. Happy to be here.
Let's start right at the beginning. Let's start with the producer. I mean, are you the first person on this project, or somebody had to go find you?
No, Rob and I went to college together. So we've been friends for a long time. We've always been talking about we're going to make something. We worked in each other's student films. The reason Rob and I bonded was because when we first kind of had our first film class together, the ideas we were pitching were like super out there as opposed to everybody else's kind of like mild, low budget, like two people having a conversation with great camera work. We were more about like, how can we make an action movie? How can we make, a samurai movie? So we made both of those and we kind of became close there. We've been friends for years. We've lived together. We've been there kind of through thick and thin. So definitely when he was working on this project, it's something I wanted to get to be a part of. I mean, I read the script. I know he was starting to do a lot of the preliminary legwork in terms of like meeting the cast. And I kind of said, hey, I think I can help you raise some money and help with some of the logistics and get this thing made. So that's kind of how it happened is, Rob kind of trusted me to work on this with him.
Well, that was nice. He trusted you. I mean, it was a great project. So you just sort of slid in there from what I'm understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, I have a digital marketing background. I know, I facilitated a lot of shoots and stuff for work. So I said, hey, I kind of have this new skill set. And, the big thing I originally off the bat said I could help with was like, okay, we need to get money from somewhere. Let's do a Kickstarter. And I kind of used that and kind of started with that. And then as we said, oh my God, we're actually going to get funded, that turned into, okay, hey, let's figure out now, like, we have this budget. Like, let's figure out what we can get for it and what we can do for it and favors we can call in and stuff like that. So it was definitely something I said, oh, yeah, I definitely have, some new skill set that I could contribute to this that would affect the movie in a positive way.
Okay. Rob, were you okay with everything your producer was doing here? It sounds like he's taking over your project.
John is being extremely modest. I basically, was completely thrilled that he wanted to be a part of it because I knew that he was really the only person who was crazy enough to try to take this project on because, typically short films, not knocking the typical short films, but yeah, when you go to film school, what most of the teachers say is just try to make something where it's just two people in a room or, like a couple people, natural light location. Just don't set the bar too high. Don't be too ambitious in terms of the scale. And we were always just trying to do the opposite. I mean, we were always sort of trying to bite off more than we could chew. And this was the sort of first project, post-film school that I think both of us were hungry again to try to reach that high and to try to do something with Hidden Temples and Dragons and, but also a comedy because we both come from, sort of comedy writing background. So I was super, super grateful that John wanted to jump in because I knew it was going to be a lot of work, both on the funding side as well as figuring out where we were going to shoot this. And, John just did an amazing, amazing job. I mean, he found our desert location. I mean, where we and as well as the house location and the rooftop location. I mean, he really jumped in and figured out a way to find a real world equivalent of these wacky geographical locations that I came up with in the script, and it elevated the movie so much. I mean, when we were shooting in the desert, it felt like we were making Lawrence of Arabia. I don't know if it actually comes across that way, but that's what it felt like when we were shooting it.
Okay, hold on. Lori Bath, you're up next. How did you come on the project? Was this something you were interested in acting or something you've always done? I don't know nothing about you, so give me some help.
Oh, acting? Yeah, I've been an actor for a long time. I'm quite popular in the States, Simon.
She is. She's very popular.
I officiate weddings. And one of the grooms from one of the weddings I had done emailed me and said, my friend's doing a short film and somebody dropped out. Would you be interested or willing to go to their read-through and just read the part? And I was like, sure, why not? And so I went and I, you know, did the part in the read-through. And I didn't know that he wanted me to be in the film. I just thought I was helping out with the read-through. And then he was like, yeah, we're going to work on the part. And I was like, oh, do you want me to be in this? And he was like, yes, of course. So I was like, all right. You know, Rob was, you know, vouched for by someone I knew. And, so that's how I got involved.
Okay.
Actually.
Wait, so sorry, am I to believe that you guys don't have Nickelodeon in Canada?
We do, but I don't watch it.
Oh, okay.
I know they might have their own programming though.
Oh, We have a YTV, which would be the equivalent of your Nickelodeon, so we may not get some of the shows. Unless it's on Netflix, I probably wouldn't see it.
Okay, so that may explain that, yeah.
I like that so accusatorily. Am I supposed to say it?
And just to provide some additional insight into how big Lori Beth is in the States, the first time that her and I went to lunch, just to talk about, I think it was either right after the first table read or right before the second one, we hadn't sat down for 5 minutes before some guy like in his early 20s just came over and just very sweetly asked if he could give Lori Beth a hug because he grew up watching her. And it was so cool watching him be so starstruck.
So I guess I'm in trouble that I have no idea who you are, Lori Beth. I'm sorry.
That's actually great, to be honest.
I am an actress, and I worked for Nickelodeon, which is a children's network. That's where I started my career. And so I was on a sketch comedy show and a game show in the 90s. So that's where people – I think you're squarely, like, older than the demographic anyway, Simon. So you're off the hook. But that's why – people 20 to 30 are excited to see me because they did grow up on me. And I do get a lot of hugs. I get and give a lot of hugs, which is very nice.
You know what's really funny? You're in a movie that I have never seen called Good Burger. It's been on my list forever to watch. So I'm going to move that up this week and keep an eye out for you.
All right. You'll look for my cameo.
Yeah. So, okay, let's get to Eduardo. I think you were, like, really perfectly cast for this. You look like you have me in about 6 months. Yeah, I'm sure they didn't let you shower for days.
Yeah, that's actually my natural state. I don't shower very often.
Well, you're in the valley. Nobody can smell you. Everybody stinks down there in those tents.
And we have dry shampoos now, you know that.
Yeah. What?
For the hair.
So how did you come to the park?
Yeah, so it's because I moved to LA and I started working at this ad agency. So by day I'm a software engineer and I was doing web development for an ad agency, and Rob worked at the same ad agency and I think he was doing digital asset management. Just kind of like one of those break room, you know, around the coffee, type of things. We were just talking about movies and, I've been acting since I was a kid as well. I wasn't an, you know, just doing like small children's theater stuff and a bunch of plays. And I got to know Rob and we started talking about movies, and he told me that he was writing this movie. He sent along the script and I read it and I just immediately fell in love and was like, man, whatever I can do to just help you, you know, make this would be amazing. And it was kind of funny because I didn't know where I fit in that whole process. I didn't know if he wanted me to like act in it or, but you know, luckily he did. And, I was just a big believer from the very beginning. I wanted to get this thing made.
Okay, now I've given you guys all a chance to talk. You can fight over who's going to talk from now on. Okay, you guys do black and white at the start of the film. Was that definite to set up the flashback scene?
In terms of, like, the choice to start in the future in black and white kind of thing?
No, that came later, right?
Oh, yeah, that came a little bit later. Yeah, so basically, that came out of, after we did the table read and I started thinking about how magical what we were going for was going to be, I thought, you know what, I kind of wanted to give it sort of a Wizard of Oz type feel, because it does sort of take a magical realism approach to the valley, and I was really, really inspired by a movie called Nothing Lasts Forever. It's a movie that's never officially been released, but you can find bootlegs of it, and it's a movie made in the early 80s that's supposed to look like it was made in the 1930s about the future. And I just thought, I was just kind of, along with the other influences of the movie, I just got kind of swept up in it. And, you know, also, I just wanted more Lori Beth in the movie. You know, it was so fun seeing her bring her role to life at the table read and the rehearsals that we had. I just thought we got to get more Lori Beth in there. And if she is willing to wear old age makeup, then okay. And why not add some flying cars too?
Yeah, that was pretty fun. My real life boyfriend actually ended up playing my husband in the movie. So it was fun to, and we were just fighting the whole time and taking stabs at each other. And then we acted out the movie. So our couple, our characters are just bickering and sick of each other and all that kind of stuff. And so then it just kicked it up a notch when we got all, like, gray-haired and old. And I remember it took a while to set things up. So he and I were just sitting on the couch in our old-age makeup, just, like, riffing for a really long time. That was pretty funny. I wonder if there's any B-roll of that. I don't think we were rolling, but that would be just kind of gold.
There's definitely B audio roll and worth looking into releasing an album of just the between the.
So I was to hear that.
So what was interesting about the flashback scene is when Rob and I were kind of reviewing it, I would say that was probably the most written and rewritten part of the entire movie. I think, you know, everything that kind of takes place in, like, present day almost is basically like what it was from, like, the first draft I saw. But there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, do we need this scene? How much should we do? Should it be jokey? Should it be serious? You know, it took up a lot more time in the original draft. You know, there was the realtor was like a major, more of a major character. I think at one point we wrote the draft where Dan was dead at the end and she's holding an urn or something. It was a little dark. So, but I think what we ended up coming up with, and I think the final idea ended up working really well. I know the black and white, originally I think that we were between black and white and having kind of like an old school, like really matted color, but I think black and white was the much better choice. And I think it's funnier, you know, I just think from a comedy perspective, it's funnier to see a flying car go by with like 30 sounding music in a black and white, you know, shot of a nice old-timey cul-de-sac in the middle of Sherman Oaks.
But meanwhile, it's the future, so that's what's so funny about it. Like, it's like 2050 or whatever.
Yeah, but I'd say that was the biggest struggle to get right, I think, was the bookends. And that was even, I think, in the original cuts, too. We were back and forth, do we really need these bookends? But they really, in my opinion, I think everybody here agrees that they really do add something. They add a little bit of, you know, obviously, yeah, we get more of Lori Beth and Tyler. But I think they do add kind of a perspective, and they do kind of set the stage that you're entering this kind of really weird world instead of just dropping you into the middle of it.
Okay, well, good answers. Eduardo, do you got anything to add? Because you didn't say anything.
No, I agree with all of that.
Okay, next question. We'll start off with Eduardo then.
I'm on board.
How was working with
those scenes?
Eduardo, do you know the reason why we're using shopping carts?
Yeah, I mean, so the shopping carts are so rampant in the valley. I don't know why, but yeah, people just seem to kind of take them and leave them and use them and not use them. But everywhere you go, if you just drive around the valley, through Burbank, through Glendale, through, Van Nuys, there's just these shopping carts laid everywhere. And it's just this wonderful motif for, these things that are, you know, like Jake says, you know, there's these like wonderful things that get left behind. And yeah, and it was a good sort of, kind of an anchor for me to think about, the shopping cart and what it represents. But yeah, I don't know, Rob, if you have anything more to say about
kind of. Yeah, no, you completely hit it on the head. And actually, you know, when I first moved out to LA, John and his wife were nice enough to put me up. And I just remember I was walking everywhere because I didn't have a car. I came from New York, and it was something that I just did not notice on the East Coast. It almost feels like something specific to LA, even though that's probably not the case, but it just feels like they're everywhere. And it's almost like looking at the sky at night. If you see one star, you start to see all of them. And I was just agog at how many shopping carts there were. And I just thought, you know, how great would it be if they were sort of there for a reason instead of just kind of being randomly there? What if they added up to something? And, you know, it also just seems to, you know, kind of like whatever Arto said, just speak to, you know, kind of a, you know, something that's been abandoned, but, you know, it was useful at one time and it's, you know, now been abandoned. And I think he's sort of talking about himself when he says that. It's kind of on the nose, but that's sort of what he's referring to when he talks about it. So they seem like a fun, just physical device, but also a metaphor for what he's looking for within himself.
Did you have problems finding the red shopping cart, or that's the easy one to find and all the other ones were hard?
Well, believe it or not, and John can jump in and talk about this too, the way that we filmed all of our shopping cart montage scenes were, we just sort of asked ourselves, you know, with our luck, if we drive around looking for shopping carts, we're not going to find them. But if we have them with us, you know, it's like Murphy's Law, but we knew that if we had them with us. So what we essentially did was with our amazing production designer, Pinch Lee, who is Greg's wife. Greg plays the adventurer. She worked on Stranger Things. She's worked on a lot of great projects. She actually just said, you know, I have like 4 or 5 shopping carts. I can lend them to you guys. So John and I sort of put our heads together, and I think it was John that really said, you know, we could just rent a giant van. Like, we could make a shopping cart mobile and just drive around. We had a lot of locations in mind already, but we thought we can drive around. If there aren't any shopping carts, we can pull one out. And the red one was one of them. We had a red one. We had one with yellow trim. We had one with green trim. And it was a little hairy at times. I mean, the LAPD was driving past us wondering, what are these weirdos doing?
But what was crazy was more often than not, there would be a shopping cart there. Or yeah. I remember I was driving the van and John is the other John is our DP. I just remember him yelling shopping cart, and we just pull over and jump out. Everybody in costume comes pouring out. We're doing this like gorilla, you know, running down with this shopping cart that we found in this perfect place. You know, it was interesting. You know, it was a lot of just running gun with those. You know, we had a bunch of shopping carts in the van, but I think we probably pulled them out. I think most of the carts that you see were already in the locations by randomly. I think except for where it's like a super staged location, we brought them, but a lot of locations we just kind of found as we were driving along. And if we saw a cart there, we would just jump out and grab it and film it.
Yeah, it was funny because like way before the movie was even a possibility, I just started taking as many photos as I could, kind of like Jake, and I started cataloging a lot of the locations. So when we actually went out and shot, we at least had enough locations that we could go to them if we had to. But on the way, we found so much. I'd say like half of them were planned. Half of them were just stuff we found. Like there's a whole block that was burned down that we just happened to cross. It's in the montage where they're hunting for shopping carts. And, you know, the train bridge was obviously, you know, that was a happy accident that the train happened to be there that day. But, yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. And John was a real hero for driving that van for sure.
Okay, we'll get Lori Beth back in here. Lori Beth,
yeah.
your real-life boyfriend in the film, says a line, it ruins the fantasy. I'm playing baseball.
Yes.
Was that ad-libbed, or is that just something that normally happens in your world?
No, that was actually in the script, and it was probably my favorite line. It's so funny when I'm playing fantasy baseball. It ruins the fantasy that I'm playing baseball. It was probably my favorite. I think at one point it might have been cut, and I was like, dude, Rob, you've got to put that back in.
Yeah. Lori Beth was a big advocate for that line, and I think it really was a great Tyler line.
Yeah, it was. It was just my favorite thing. I love jokes like that where you say the same thing twice and it means different things. Actually, I never told you that, Rob, but that's like one of my favorite things.
Oh, that's so cool.
Okay. Well, my favorite part is that line, or the one that says, not Wayne Brady rich, but Drew Carey rich. Is there really a difference?
I can say just on one level, or just not on a level, but I can just say that was absolutely an ad lib by Greg. Greg really got excited in that moment, and I think he was just like, you know, is there any other way I can express, you know, how powerful the treasure can be, how big the riches can be? And I just said, go right ahead. That was one of Greg's one of his free takes where he just threw that in. And yeah, no, the difference between Drew Carey Rich and Wayne Brady Rich, I almost feel like it was a joke within a joke, because I don't think there is a whole lot of...
Yeah, I was like, I think they're probably Wayne Brady's a very wealthy man. Like, that's, I would scoff at being Wayne Brady Rich.
Yeah, maybe it's just inherently racist.
Old money versus new money.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Eduardo, how does it feel to have your face on a book cover? And who made it for you?
I believe that was Pinch. Is that correct?
It was Pinch and her. She had, like, sort of a little team that helped her out. And, yeah, she you know, we really just kind of had this basic idea. When I was writing it, I just had this basic idea. Like, it could have, like, kind of a 70s... You know, something you would see in a library that maybe nobody has checked out because it's too weird. And we also kind of wanted it to feel like something that Jake could have made, you know, on his own. Like, you know, it's not something that, you know, like, you wouldn't call it like a mid-century, like a modern looking book. He's kind of stuck in the past. But yeah, that was definitely a total awesome creation of Pinch and her team.
And you also have a promotional poster of yourself on Lori Beth's wall at the end of the film. Who got to take that home? Do you have that sitting at home now, Eduardo?
No, I actually don't know where that is. That the one where I'm taking the picture, right? Is
yes.
That, yeah. Oh,
the like the reporter. Painting or the picture?
Painting, yeah.
Yes, the painting, that again was a Pinch special.
But who has that?
Yeah, who has
it's
in my closet. I never should have taken that. I'm sorry. I should have made that call on set.
It's on loan to the Louvre, and we're not allowed to go there. They don't
it's a
LACMA
exhibit.
Yeah, exactly.
Rob's got a shrine in his closet that he prays to every night.
I thank the movie gods for it.
You have a very distinctive look for each character. Lori's Beth character, I find, has a distinct look. Her husband has a distinct look. Eduardo has a distinct look. Was that the plan, that everybody looks different? Like, even the costume design of the warrior was good.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I think Lori Beth and Everardo and Greg, they definitely brought a lot in terms of what they wanted their characters to look like. But Pinch brought a ton as well. And I think Pinch's whole concept was that, you know, she wanted the costumes to sort of feel like, I guess, like hyper real. Like, if they were all action figures, they would make sense as action figures. Like, if you look at the Adventurer's outfit, he has this yellow car collector vest. It echoes the yellow shirt that Everardo has. And just this totally awesome blue sweater type thing that Lori Beth has, it just somehow completely complements them as a group when they're all walking to the temple. It was definitely a real feat in terms of making everybody look unique. And the shopping cart warrior armor was a lot of fun and very crazy to build. That was built by somebody different. His name's Nathaniel Emond. He lives in Seattle now, and he basically just said, "You get me a shopping cart, and I'll we'll build a costume. So I somehow got my hands on the shopping cart. I'm not 100% sure how, but it ended up in my car. And
he has to say that.
Yes, but please, you guys, please speak about your costumes. I don't want to step on everything you're saying.
First of all, I need to take a moment and say Pinchley is so awesome that I want her to leave her husband Greg and marry me.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. She just like put on 75 hats and knocked every one of them out of the park. She's such a cool, talented, smart lady. So when she and I talked, I'd kind of gotten the idea like that my character, what's my character's name, Rob?
Molly.
She's like, hi. Molly was kind of very prim and wanted everyone to think she was, you know, proper and put together, and that, you know, she one of the things is like, oh, I would never allow someone to come to my house uninvited because it wasn't clean enough. But meanwhile, it's totally cleaner than anyone else's house to start with. So a little tightly wound. And so when Pinch and I went shopping, you know, she had that in mind. I think Rob said, you know, yeah, Molly's like an office manager somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Office manager at a dentist's office or something. So when we went shopping, Pinch really had, you know, this concept. And so she picked out things that fit what she was seeing in her head. And we just came up with a really fun little sweatery, you know, cardi stick up your butt outfit.
Well said.
I mean, what I also think is great, I mean, and this is probably, you know, my favorite part of the movie is really just the little details. And I think that's what, you know, when I show it to people and I've shown it to people, they're always kind of impressed by like, oh, you like thought of like everything. Like, you know, even the ancillary characters, you know, the gang members that show up, the homeless gentleman in the beginning. It's everybody kind of has, like you said, kind of a look, and they're very like, you know, it's like, for example, with the gang members, I mean, that was like, you know, I reached out to a graphic designer I know named Jimmy D'Onofrio, and I was like, hey, it would be, can you make us like a weird patch for this scene? And he just busted out, you know, like four variations of this logo, and then it just became, oh, hey, I found like a bunch of jean jackets on Amazon, like, Pinch, what can you do with them? And she cut sleeves off and kind of built these like characters out of there who they're on the screen for maybe 30 seconds, but you know, they're almost like signature, you know, they come off with this like signature look. I mean, the same for the homeless guy in the beginning. I mean, it's, you know, he just kind of showed up and we were like, you know, I think he's wearing like dog tags, but they're like his dog. So it's like, yeah, you know, it's right. Just little details that we put in. I mean, there was, you know, the gang members, again, all wear kind of bandanas in their back pockets that have different sayings. I mean, there's little, like, inside jokes and little things that we kind of dress not only in the set but in the costumes. And, you know, I'm glad you pointed out that everybody has this distinct look, because that was very much kind of, you know, a big thing that I know I was stressing and Rob was a big stressor of, that, you know, it needs to look kind of like nothing else. And, you know, every character needs to, like, have their impact moment and their kind of signature look to it. Another thing Rob did with some of the costume designs was for the adventurer. And this is something that nobody's going to notice, but Rob told me this and I thought this was brilliant. As he gets kind of like more along his quest and as he kind of does his turn, he, you know, his costume really changes. He goes from this big duster to kind of like a shirt and hat to then just kind of like his vest and goggles. Like we kind of see him almost in every scene as he's going on this quest looking a little bit different.
He does. Eduardo, what did you think of your outfit?
Yeah, I was going to say just more to add to the attention to detail. It was just so awesome. Everything became a character, really. I mean, down to the camera. I mean, that camera is, you know, it's an actual old film camera. And it just has such a cool look and such a cool feel to it that it really, in my eyes, became a character on its own, right? You just kind of see it live and breathe the way any character would. And I think that there's just so many little details like that, down to, you know, the sweater that I had, the shirt that I was wearing. It was just a livable, breathable thing that I wanted to keep, but I couldn't.
Oh, well, we still have it, Everett. It's all
really the jacket.
I'm pretty sure I have every. If you guys just want to raid my closet, I think it's all just safe. It's safe. So if you guys want to come get it, it's all.
Oh man, don't even
just steal my entire wardrobe because I.
It's all here.
How is working with CGI effects as actors and directors, producers? Let's get into that a bit. How did that go?
It was a bit of a challenge in the beginning, only because, you know, it was a movie where our ambitions were sort of what we were following, and we hadn't really made, anything before where, not only is there CGI in the sense of there's a completely, fake temple there, but, and we had to use green screen for that, obviously. But, we also really had to try hard to make, Slord the Dragon a character. So it was an evolution process. It was definitely a case of, we would sort of, take some baby steps and then kind of step back and see how it felt. It definitely took, it was the longest part of the post-production process for sure, is just sort of finding the right tone in terms of not trying to be too campy and trying to make it feel, maybe John can help me out with the language more. It's almost like we wanted it to feel grounded, but also kind of silly. Like, we didn't want it to feel completely silly. We wanted it to feel like it was a real temple, but we wanted there to be a shopping cart on top. Like, we wanted that part to be believable. And, when it came to Slord, there were a few different ideas that we had. There was one where he would have like a shopping cart on his head and stuff like that. And I think in the end, we really just wanted to scare the heck out of people and just make something that looked like it could have, flown out of Game of Thrones. So it was just sort of a, tone juggling, and just seeing what stuck. And we definitely learned a lot, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, what's cool about that was I know the original idea, and I was always kind of in on this, and I know we had it back and forth. Like, the original idea for Slord was that he was going to look like kind of like a Ray Harryhausen, like, almost, like, really awkward stop-motion thing. But
yeah.
I'm very glad he didn't do that. The cool thing about Slord, and a lot of, this is another one of those little details that's lost. Slord has these orange veins. The inspiration for that was when we originally had Slord, he just was black. And we were kind of just like, that's cool, but, it's got to have something related to the valley. So what our effects editor did was he found a map of we have the orange line in the valley. We have very, very bad limited public transportation, but we do have a regional rail. It's called the Orange Line. So the veins on Slork, he has these kind of yellowish-orange veins that go down him. Those actually are the pattern of the Orange Line that goes through the valley. That starts in Van Nuys, and I think it goes to downtown. But that was kind of the inspiration for his final look. And I think that kind of – nobody's ever going to know that or notice that, but it was one of the things where I'm like, okay, it gives him a distinct look, and if you really, like – read into it, it has something to do with it. It kind of brings the character back to this, like, magical realist valley place.
And just to piggyback on that, I think what really, really sold it in the end, and what made it easier to make the VFX seem real, is that, even though it's comedy, it really did feel like, Lori Beth and Greg and Brad, who plays the Treasure Guardian, and Everardo, and basically everybody, they were really good at reacting to stuff that just wasn't there. And I now realize how hard that is for an actor, because it wasn't even like we were holding up, a final picture of what Slord was going to look like. They just had to sort of imagine that, Greg was being eaten alive in front of them. And it seems like it's really happening. I mean, it's a comedy, but they definitely seem like they're being affected by a man being swallowed whole by a dragon.
Okay, I want to go over a few more things before we get to the end. I want to discuss the wonderful treasure map design for a bit.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was phenomenal. Yes. That looked like work.
It was, and that was, again, Pinchley, in addition to doing the costumes, she also did the overall production design. I mean, she essentially, you know, built the base camp that the adventurer has. I mean, she came up with the look for that.
She actually played all the parts.
It's really just
Pinterest. And wrote.
She built the houses that we built.
She
made the desert. Yeah. She just found some sand and just built stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty
cool. Go ahead.
No. We talked about this. You weren't going to reveal all that. We really wanted sort of a map of the valley that looked not so much like a current map, but also not like a super old-timey map. So what we sort of settled on in the end was, I think it was a map from maybe the 60s or the 70s. You know, do you remember the period that was from, John? I feel like it was like mid-century, maybe? Because there were some things that weren't on there that are currently on there.
John? Did we lose John?
John.
I guess John.
Hello, John.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I see him.
I think he's on mute.
He's on mute.
John, are you muted?
Uh-oh.
John just goes, I need to take five. I'll come back.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
I'm not going to edit this.
John does have a child, too. But no, I'll just continue. Yeah, so basically Pinch came up with this, you know, totally cool retro-looking map that we actually did augment a little bit in post. You know, we added sort of the hidden cave of Sepulveda Boulevard in post. So it was sort of a really cool marriage between physical production design and post design. But again, you know, you believe that you're looking at something fantastic because, you know, Everardo and Greg look like they're staring at it. And, you know, that's, again, why all the scenes with Lori Beth are freaking awesome, because she seems truly affected by everything that's happening in front of her.
Lori Beth, Eduardo, don't think that you're my favorite character. Don't take this offensive. I just love you. Eduardo, you just seem like this guy in high school that I just think never amounted to anything.
Oh, man. Thank you.
I think you did a great job. My last question is about the upbeat music. Are you going for an Indiana Jones theme, or am I reading into this?
No, you're not reading too much into it at all. That's exactly what we were going for. Our amazing composer, Steve Wilder Blumenthal, who he's not only an amazing composer, he has one of the greatest names I've ever heard.
Right.
He you know, really, really came up with this amazing score that it was not just we wanted to go for Indiana Jones, but a big influence that we really wanted to go for, especially in the second montage when they're on that bridge, was Hans Zimmer. You know, because every Hans Zimmer score, it's just got this escalation to it. It just feels like it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's got sort of a orchestral sound, but, you know, helped out a lot by synth sounds. So, you know, Steve really, really got it. You know, we had a lot of discussions early on about, should it be comedy adventure score or just adventure score? And we settled on adventure because we thought the more serious it was, the more, you know, it would make the comedy seem real. I mean, basically, the more we took this journey seriously, which is completely ridiculous, the more it might help sell it. So, Steve did an amazing job, and he actually released the soundtrack, his original soundtrack. So people can listen to that. Spotify. It's on, Amazon. You can find it on our Facebook page.
Okay. Eduardo, since we're going about getting close to wrapping up, not quite close enough. Do you see a sequel for your character? And Lori Beth, I know you're coming back for the sequel, so I don't need to worry about that.
I hope so. I mean, I kind of want to find out, what happens to him, you know, he was kind of, had nothing, and then suddenly he's the new,
Don't give away the ending!
I did not give away anything!
I mean,
amateur!
No, but yeah, I hope that we have, there's more to Jake's story, yeah, I hope so.
I'm such a jerk!
No, I agree with you.
It's like the, Mark Ruffalo and the Don Cheadle, you ever watch? Never mind.
Well, since John's not here, he's going to have to catch
go
up.
Go ahead, please, Everardo. We know what you're saying.
I think he gives away the ending to the Avengers or something.
He does.
Oh, yes. I think he did.
Yeah.
It's more about the journey. It's okay. It's more about the journey.
Okay. Absolutely.
Well, I have to ask these. I have, at the end of every show, I ask three fun questions of my guests.
Ooh.
So I know you guys have randomly listened. They're all random, so you can listen to every episode you want, but I make them up every time, so good luck. So
okay.
All of you get the same okay. question to start, and then we'll go from there. Favorite film?
This is LB. My favorite film is Broadcast News, 1986, Jim Brooks.
Good choice.
This is Everardo. My favorite film is Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese.
Oh, gosh, great choice. This is Rob, and I got to say, just in terms of I'm at war because it's actually two movies. The first one is Repo Man, which is a classic 80s cult film. The second one is a movie called Innerspace, which is a
short movie.
Super funny. I mean, tonally, our movie, I think we were going for something like that. It's a real fun adventure movie about a pilot, a test pilot, who gets injected into somebody else, and they talk to each other. It's Martin Short and Dennis Quaid.
Wow.
Both super fun movies. And they warped my brain as a child, so...
Okay, second question. A movie.
Wait, we need him from John.
He's not
oh,
here.
John,
yeah, I'm back.
Oh, John's back.
Yeah.
Oh, he's back.
John needed to... Oh, is he back? John, are you back?
Yeah.
Been What's back. Your favorite film, John, before I go to question two?
That's a hard one for me. I would say in terms of the movie that, like, most got me into movies was probably Rocky.
Fair enough. Okay, question two. A movie you've never seen and should have, since you all live in L.A. or nearby...
Ooh. It's LB. It's funny, I've been listening to this podcast called Movie Crush, and they take deep dives into movies every week, and so I'm making a list of the ones I want to see, and there's old ones, like, I want to see The Maltese Falcon.
Oh,
like, there's
God.
All these classic, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is another one that I was like, why haven't I seen that 50 times? So I'm building a list to go out and educate myself.
There you go.
I'll go next.
Yeah, you go next, please.
Oh, it's okay. probably A Clockwork Orange. I've never seen it, and I have always wanted to read the book, and I feel like I can't do either of those. Or I don't know if I should watch the movie first or read the book first, but I'm just like in this like limbo state.
They're very different items. I've done both. So I don't think it'll matter to you. I'd read the book first, so wish to know what you're missing.
Read the English printing of the book. It actually has a 21st chapter that was cut out of the American release of the book.
Ooh.
That really gives it a whole other...
This is legit. I've read it. It's good.
All right. Gotta start my journey.
Start your journey. I would say, this is Rob, I'm a big Peter Bogdanovich fan. I love Paper Moon, I love, Mask is another great one that he did. I just watched a movie he did called St. Jack, which is fantastic. I've never seen The Last Picture Show, and I heard The Last Picture Show.
Oh, my God, kick him off right now.
Far and away his best movie. That's just what I heard.
It is an amazing film. I watched it this year, Make You Feel Better, about 3 months ago to finish that problem off.
Oh, okay. All right. So I should see it. You're saying I should watch it.
I loved it. Loved it.
Oh, great. Okay. Then it's happening.
John?
I'm going to go a little bit newer. I'm a huge action guy. I love action movies, but I have actually never seen John Wick.
Oh, God, wow.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I can't do Dogs Dying, so I just haven't been able to watch it.
Okay, here's your really strange question for all of you. Since your film takes place involving shopping carts, what is your favorite place to go shopping because you like the shopping carts?
Oh, Target, definitely. Target shopping carts are pretty sweet. Good handle, nice grip. They're red. It makes you feel very, like, racy car. I might want to go right now that I talk to
you. I have to second that. Yeah, Target's got the best shopping carts. They got good steering. They're kind of lower to the ground, so you get more torque. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to do a strike vote against the Target shopping carts because they have those wheels that lock automatically, and if you park outside of the parking garage, they don't let you take the cart to your cart, but I totally understand. Uh-huh. I get it. My favorite ones are from my hometown. There's a little grocery store where I grew up in Connecticut called Bethel Food Mart, and those are pretty cherry shopping carts. Like Everardo said, the torque is outstanding.
So my favorite is actually, this is going to be one maybe some people listening can relate to, a store called Bye Bye Baby. It is a kid and baby supply store. They have these baby blue shopping carts. The reason I like them, there's nothing special about them, but if you're a man by yourself pushing one of those, everybody will be so nice and so helpful because they will assume you have no idea what you're doing and are completely lost. So the minute you walk into the store, just kind of let your eyes glaze over and push one of those carts and people come out of the woodwork to help you.
That's awesome. I don't think people can find your film right now because it's still on the festival circuit, right?
Right. Well, they can't, but it's actually, if they're in the L.A. area, we could plug where it's going to be playing on the big screen.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, you can go to any of our social channels. We're on Twitter.com, Cart Wrangler. It's one word, Cart Wrangler. Instagram.com, Lost Treasure Movie. And then Facebook.com, Lost Treasure Movie. And you can get tickets to our screening, which is on Thursday, September 26th at 10 p.m. at the Lemley NoHo 7 in North Hollywood. And you can also just do a Google search. In the Valley. It's the Valley Film Festival. And you could just do a search also for just they're on Eventbrite. So you could just do Eventbrite Lost Treasure, and it should pop up as the first thing in Google search.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming here. And you can also check Lori Beth if you can find old YouTube of Nickelodeon Untold, which I will be doing later today. Eduardo, do you have something to plug?
No, I'm off the grid. I'm not on any social media or anything. So you can find me maybe around, North Hollywood, the North Hollywood Target.
There you go.
Just wandering around.
I'll look for you in the red shopping cart. I'll know it's you. Well, thank
Lori
everybody.
Beth is in the new season of All That, I should say. That Lori Beth was on the new season of All That. She's in some episodes.
Oh yeah, that's true. They did it. They're doing a reboot of the main show that I did on Nickelodeon. And so there's a new cast of kids, and they've had some of the original cast members, including me, come back and play. And that's been a lot of fun.
Cool. Everybody, check it out. The film. Check out Eduardo sitting in shopping cart somewhere in North Hollywood.
Yep.
And everybody have a great night. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, thanks again for having us on. Even though our film is only currently playing in film festivals, you can check out the original soundtrack to Lost Treasure of the Valley on our composer's Bandcamp page. It's stevewilderblumenthal.bandcamp.com. The name Steve Wilder, W-I-L-D-E-R, Blumenthal, Blumenthal, .bandcamp.com. And you can actually purchase the original soundtrack to Lost Treasure of the Valley. It's super 80s Indiana Jones inspired. It'll give you a really good feel of the movie and just the tone that we had. And you can drive around with it playing in your car and just imagine you're inside the adventurous Wild West that is the Valley. Please go check it out. It's a really killer soundtrack.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.